Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Next month in May is the time that we traditionally celebrate Vesak, which is the celebration of the birth, enlightenment, and passing away of the Buddha. And we usually celebrate on the full moon of May. And this year there are two full moons in May. And so some of the people in this tradition will be celebrating on the first full moon, which is the beginning of May. And here we'll be celebrating Vesak at the end of May. And we actually have two celebrations. On the 31st of May, which is the actual full moon day, we'll be celebrating with a day of meditation practice here, a day of silent meditation practice, where people can come together from about 9 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon and practice in noble silence with meditation instruction from myself. And with the other nuns from Dharmasara here to join in. And the whole day is conducted in silence. So even our meal in the middle of the day we take in silence and as part of the practice. And that's on the actual full moon day, the 31st of May. And then on the 3rd of June, which is the closest Sunday to that Thursday, we'll be having our usual celebration here, which includes talks and items from the Dharma School children and various other events before we have our circumambulation around the shrine that we set up in the park across the road. And in the moonlight with candles, we walk 3 times around the shrine in silence again to venerate the Buddha. And to establish or re-establish or reaffirm our relationship to the Buddha as our teacher, the one who shows us the way. And this is actually a very beautiful time of the year, a very beautiful occasion. It's a very inspiring and uplifting occasion. And it's part of our tradition that we do that once a year, but it's also one of the traditional ways that we prepare the mind for meditation and that we support the mind in our daily life to do what is called Buddhanusati, which is the recollection of the qualities of the Buddha, the virtues of the Buddha, and the recollection of what makes him so special, to make us more aware of what he accomplished, to make us reflect on the Dharma that he has provided us with, the path of practice, and to give us inspiration to realize the same sort of wisdom and compassion that he realized, to realize that in our own life. And so tonight I'd like to speak about Buddhanusati, sati meaning contemplation or focusing on the Buddha. And for some of you who come along here to learn about meditation without any sense of real interest in Buddhism as such, you may be apt to think, well, I don't really want to know about the Buddha or about Buddhism, I just want to know about the practice of meditation. And it's actually a part of the fact of the quality of meditation that we don't have to have any sense of belief in the teacher in order to follow the instructions relating to the mind, because what the Buddha pointed out, the universal characteristics of the mind, pertain to all of us and to each of us, whether we call ourselves a Buddhist or not. And so in that sense, we don't have to have this personal connection to the teacher. We can follow the instructions to take up the breath, to settle the attention in the present moment, and just use that simple practice to help us to discover the peace in the mind that exists there already as part of our birthright. So we don't have to have this strong connection with the teacher, but it certainly helps if we have that. If we have that confidence that the Buddha did know what he was talking about, and that the instructions that he provides us with will take us all the way to enlightenment at the most, but at the very least to deep peace and to understanding of the mind, understanding of ourselves. Because when we start to practice, particularly if we're starting with watching the breath, and we don't find instant peace of mind, and we find ourselves quite disappointed with the results that we get, or we find ourselves struggling with the way the mind resists staying in one place, then we can very easily give up, thinking that, well, maybe this instruction doesn't work, there must be an easier way. And we might think, well, I can't do this practice, I'm not going to stick with this. So we don't have any really connection to this path, then it's very easy for our own mind to set up limitations of what we can accomplish. But if we have this connection to the teacher, and we see that he was the Buddha, a human being like ourselves, is able to accomplish this wonderful thing, if we start to learn about his life and learn about the struggles that he went through, the difficulties he had to overcome, then we start to realize, well, there is some similarity. He was a human being like me, and he had to overcome the defilements, the things that take us away from this present moment, take us away from peace and happiness. The defilements that are talked about again and again in this path of practice are not something which are peculiar to us because we have a sinful mind, or because we are less worthy than the Buddha. The Buddha, who accomplished so much, started off with a mind that was also very flighty, that was also unable to stay in the present moment, that was distracted by desire, ideas of wanting something pleasant, not something unpleasant, that was harried by fears and anxieties, that was sometimes overcome by anger and distress. So if we start to hear about this, that the Buddha was like us, then it can give us some encouragement and can help us to sustain our practice through the difficulties, particularly in the beginning stage, when it is perhaps seeming that we're not getting the results that we were hoping for. And when we go further in this practice and we see how the Buddha sets out the path so methodically, so logically, in such a very graduated and gradual way. How he talks to the different experiences that we have, the different aspects of the path. And we start to open up to that with gratitude and appreciation, with wonder. Then that can give us the energy that we need to keep coming back. It can give us the inspiration that we need to keep coming back and to start stretching ourselves in ways which we thought we could never do. So when we hear, for example, that the Buddha recommended that we keep precepts, that we restrain our behavior in everyday life if we want to develop the purity in the mind, first we might think, well, I'm not in for that. I just want the meditation. But then as our understanding and our confidence grows in the teaching and that the Buddha knew what he was talking about, we take it on trust that to do that is something that's useful. And so we might find ourselves saying no to behaviours that we just always took for granted. So, for example, behaviours like being aggressive on the road. We start to question that. We start to see, I'm trying to be harmless. Maybe that's one area of my life where I'm not being harmless because I'm constantly angry when I'm driving. Or in relation to using drugs and alcohol, which we may have grown up with as part of our just what we do, our normal behavior. And then we start to question whether that's really helpful. And we start to be willing to experiment and see, can I do without it? If I think I'm doing this by choice, do I have a choice or am I driven on the weekend or in the right situation to just fall into this behavior? Actually, I'm not in control. So then if we have confidence that the Buddha's saying, if you want to get results in your meditation, you can't divorce it from the way you live the rest of your life. And so we, on trust and with confidence, we stretch ourselves and challenge some of those behaviours and see what it takes to change those habit patterns in the mind. And we may find it's difficult, and so we really need to have somewhere that we can find some inspiration, can recharge our batteries. And we find our meditation may not be enough. So we need to have that connection with the teacher or connection with those who are practicing, which helps us to stick with it when the going gets tough, when we find that we don't have enough inner strength to just push through with willpower. We need actually some sweetness there. We need something to help us. And the connection to the Buddha can really be that sweetness. When we start to learn about his life and learn about his struggles and see that he had to deal with the sorts of things that we have to wrestle with. And so this is one of the particular reasons why we do this contemplation on the Buddha, to help to develop that source of strength, that source of inspiration, through seeing the Buddha's life and our own life as having so many similarities. When we get into difficult times and we can call on that recollection of the Buddha to help us, that is a great asset. And so the way that we approach this Buddha Anusati and the way that I'd like to approach it tonight is to specifically contemplate the qualities of the Buddha that we very often hear repeated in the chanting that we do. So when we chant at the end of our session here tonight, Arahang Samma Sambuddha Bhagava, we chant those three qualities of the Buddha, Arahang, Samma, Sambuddha, and Bhagava. Those are Pali words, the ancient language of India that the Buddha used. And the word arahang refers to the quality of the Buddha, particularly to do with his purity, his freedom from all internal conflicts. And the words that we use in the traditional explanation of these, or the labels that we use, is the freedom from all greed, hatred and delusion. And because of this inner purity and this freedom from internal conflicts, the Buddha had not only internal freedom, but external freedom. The greed, the hatred and the delusion are what binds us to this world. The greed or desire, the craving, even just the craving to be, the craving to exist, is the most fundamental desire. And we see this again and again in the most life-threatening situations. People fight to stay alive, strive to keep going. And we can notice it in ourselves, just the very thoughts that we mightn't be here in the next moment or mightn't be here tomorrow. It's abhorrent to us. We can't contemplate it. But this craving to being is what drives us to constantly seek to have comfort, to seek to have security, to seek to have things the way that we'd like them to be. To go out and work hard to be able to purchase the things that we'd like to have. To work hard to be able to put that money away in our superannuation so that we'll be secure and safe in later years. We don't even know if we're going to be here in later years, but the thought that we don't have anything to fall back on is a cause of distress in the mind, and we're encouraged to think that it's really important to look ahead and look to the future. And so this craving to be is very, very much something which is fueled by what we're exposed to moment after moment, day after day. How we try to think out, what have I got to do to get through today in the least difficult way, the least stressful way, so that I can get what I want from the day. All of that is a reflection or an outflowing of the craving to be, and the craving to have things as nicely, as comfortably as possible, and to avoid those things which we don't like. And this is what the Buddha was free of. This constant push, this constant striving to manipulate life, to have it the way that we want it to be. And if you can just for a moment, reflect what it might be like not to have that kind of worry, not to have that kind of push. This is the inner freedom that the Buddha experienced after his enlightenment. It's hard for us to comprehend. We think, well, it can't be possible to be without that because who'd get up in the morning and go to work then? Who would do what needs to be done? How would the world keep running? Well, the Buddha didn't stop working from the time of his enlightenment till the time of his death at 80. He, for 45 years, got up every morning, actually slept very little, spent most of his time, most of the day and most of the night, serving others, teaching, spreading the Dharma, counselling those who were in crisis, teaching whoever came to him, even on his deathbed. Someone came to him as he was in the process of dying and wanted to know from the teacher's own lips the truth. And even at that time, the Buddha still taught. So it wasn't that he just curled up and didn't do anything after his enlightenment, but on the contrary, his whole life then was lived for the sake of others. And so just to contemplate that, fancy living that way and still being happy. Happy living that way. It's mind-boggling. But this was what the Buddha accomplished through being completely free of defilements. And he was able to be completely free of defilements, greed and hatred, because he was completely free of delusion. And this is what is most difficult for us to see, this delusion. We can experience what greed is like. Of course, it's so much part of what is in our mind so much of the time. We know what it's like to feel angry. We know what it's like to feel hatred sometimes. And we know that that's unpleasant. These are part of our obvious experience, our regular experience. But to know delusion, the very nature of delusion is to hide itself from us. That's why it's delusion. We can't see it. When we see it, it's no longer delusion. So the ultimate delusion, the Buddha was saying, is that we think that we're somehow in control of this life that we live, that we somehow can get to know all the ingredients, and by pulling the right strings, we'll be able to produce the sort of life we want completely. That we'll be able to control the world we live in. That we'll be able to control the people around us. We'll be able to get things just the way we want them to be. And of course, at one level, we know that's not the case. But delusion, and this is what makes it such a joke, is delusion stops us from fully waking up to it, even though we have a glimpse of it, even though we know rationally it's not true that we're in control of the world. We're not even in control of our world. And that's why we struggle so hard. The very struggle is evidence of the fact of the truth that we're not in control. The Buddha said that we can learn to come to terms with that, and by coming to terms with it and understanding it fully, then we can be at peace. And so this quality of the Buddha to be pure, to be free of greed, hatred and delusion, is something that he accomplished not by changing the outer conditions, but by changing his own mind. And the way that he approached that was through developing very deep meditation practice. Just the sort of practice that we were developing tonight. Just the practice of being able to focus in the present moment, to stay with the here and now, and to move the mind inside, not outside, not looking at the world around, trying to get a hold on the world around, but turning inwards to get a grasp of the world inside, to get a grasp of the mind. And in order to do that, we need to have a very special mind, the mind that's developed through very deep meditation. And the way that we do that is through developing this simple meditation practice that we were doing tonight. Being able to focus moment after moment on something that is actually happening right now, the breath. Something that's happening within our own mind and body. And staying focused on that until the rest of the world outside, falls away. And we're able to experience the deep peace and happiness, the deep satisfaction that abides in the mind itself. And from that experience is something quite other than our usual way of attending to the world, being in the world. We start to see that how we looked on this world, where we thought we were going to find our true peace and happiness, our security, our comfort, we start to get shaken in that view. We start to see something else that has been hidden from our view up until now, because we've always been looking outwards rather than inwards. So what we have to do if we want to come close to what the Buddha experienced is to keep on developing this meditation practice. And as we develop it, as we go on that journey, we find that the stable, strong, happy mind that we start to develop helps us to challenge the greed and the hatred that arises in the mind in the course of our ordinary everyday life. Greed and hatred no longer have such a strong hold over the mind, because as we develop our meditation practice, we have this much firmer base that is less likely to be pushed over, pushed around, unsettled, shaken by what we come in contact with, what we experience in the world. We start to find within ourselves the strength to say no to our impulses and to our habits. This inner peace, this inner strength helps us not only to say no to our habit patterns, but to see them more clearly, to see where they really take us, whether they take us to happiness or to suffering. And then we can start to see at a deeper level where our true happiness lies. Not in the outer conditions, but in the inner conditions. Now, a very interesting teaching which one of the disciples of the Buddha gave when he and fellow monks were discussing the difference between themselves and the Buddha, and how it could be possible that the Buddha could be unshaken by the things in the world. And they said to themselves, the Buddha has eyes like we have, and the Buddha has ears like we have, and the Buddha has all the other senses that we have. So how is it that he's unshaken? And this was the teaching which the Buddha himself gave. And so Venerable Sariputta, who was teaching the other monks, was just repeating a teaching which he'd heard from the Buddha. The Buddha was saying that the quality that binds us, the craving that binds us, the greed or the hatred that binds us to the things of this world, what we experience through seeing, through hearing, through smelling, through tasting, through touching, through thinking about things, doesn't abide in the eye or the ear, in the nose or the tongue, doesn't abide in the body. And it doesn't abide in the things that we're seeing or the things that we're smelling or the things that we're tasting or whatever it is that we're experiencing in the world. The binding quality doesn't rest in any of those things. The binding quality rests in the mind itself. And because it rests in the mind and not in the sense bases or in the objects of the world, that is why we can cultivate this path to freedom, to purity. If the binding quality, the grasping quality, was in the eye or the ear or the tongue or the nose or the body or in the things we see or the things that we smell, then how could we free ourselves? Because we're always seeing things, we're always hearing things, we're always smelling things. We'd have to be blind, we'd have to be deaf, we'd have to be unconscious to free ourselves, if that were the case. And the example, or the analogy that the Venerable Sariputta gives in this teaching, he says that if there was a black ox, and if there was a white ox, and they were bound together by a very strong rope, could you rightly say that the white ox was binding the black ox, or that the black ox was binding the white ox? And the monk said, weren't sure. Venerable Sariputta said, you couldn't say that the white ox is binding the black ox. It's the rope that is binding them both. It's the rope between them that binds the ox, the white ox, to the black ox to the white ox. And in this simile, the white ox is the things of the world that we experience through the senses, and the black ox is this sense basis through which we have those contacts. It's the grasping in the mind which binds those two together. And it's the grasping in the mind that our practice seeks seeks to cut off. And it's because of that grasping being in the mind, and that there is a path of practice that we can follow to do that work of cutting that tie, that it is possible for us to become enlightened. It is possible for us to follow in the Buddha's footsteps. And again, Venerable Sariputta says in this teaching, if you just reflect that the Buddha has ears like we have, the Buddha has eyes like we have, the Buddha is subject to all those things just like us, and yet he became enlightened through working on the mind itself, directly on the mind, the grasping in the mind. And so the way that we work on the grasping in the mind is to slow down the mind enough to be able to see clearly the ties that bind us, the ties that bind us through greed, the ties that bind us through hatred, the ties that bind us through delusion, and to see them again and again and again, and to cut them where we see them. In order to do that, we need to establish attention in the present moment. We need to be mindful. We need to be aware. And we need to observe what's going on, see it more and more clearly, and so that's why we need to develop our mind in meditation. And that's why we need to help ourselves by living a good life in our ordinary everyday life, keeping precepts, restraining the mind, and also developing goodness. That's the way that we strengthen our resolve, strengthen the mind, slow down the mind, steady the mind, sharpen the mind, all of these things which make it possible to see where we are caught, and to work patiently and steadily where we're caught to cut those ties. And so the next quality of the Buddha that we hear about is the Sammasambuddha. And that means the Buddha who was enlightened by himself through his own efforts, not having a teacher to show him the way, but discovering for himself the path of practice, the way to enlightenment. And not only to be able to discover that path for himself, but to have the wisdom to teach that path to others. And that's why he is the Sammasambuddha. In the dispensation, we hear also about Pacheka Buddhas, which can arise at the same time as the Sammasambuddha, can find enlightenment for themselves, but are unable to teach that to others. And so we often refer to them as the silent Buddhas. They can't teach others the path of practice, whereas Sammasambuddhas, like Gautama the Buddha, in this Buddha era, was able to work out how to do it and then give us very clear guidance, very clear instructions. First of all, to the disciples of his time, and those disciples were able to practice to reach the same result, and then from disciple to disciple to keep the teaching alive and pass it down to us today. And this in itself is something marvelous to contemplate, because if we think about where did this hall come from, where do we all get this teaching from, how do we have monks and nuns who can practice, who can teach us, how do we have these resources? We might say, well, from the Buddhist Society, WA. But if we look back step by step by step, we see that it's an unbroken lineage of teachers, one after the other, teaching their disciples, and their disciples teaching someone else, and maybe those disciples then putting down those teachings in writing, and through books, through tapes in modern times, we receive the teaching not directly from a teacher that's living with us that we can see, but those teachings come nonetheless through these lineage of disciple to disciple. And so when we contemplate this, this is one of the ways that we can connect to the Buddha, to think that he was the one that started it all. Being the Sammasambuddha, he's the head of the lineage, and we are following in his footsteps. We are his disciples receiving the benefits of what he did and all those who've gone before us. And then the other quality that we chant about, Bhagava, the way that this is translated is usually to use the word the Lord or the Blessed One, to really show our great deep respect for the Buddha. Not with the idea at all that the Buddha was supernatural or that he was a god or that he was the messenger of the gods or that he somehow was given his ability to teach us through some sort of otherworldly connection, but to acknowledge that when he was teaching, he taught the Dharma in a way that was appropriate to the people who were hearing the teaching, that he was able to apportion or deliver the Dharma in ways that everyone could understand, from those who were the scholars of his day, those who were the religious people of his day, to the most simple people, even to children. He could impart the Dharma in a way that they could understand not only what he was saying, but that they could put it into practice. And so this is the quality of Bhagava, the Lord, the one who's wise enough to teach the Dharma in ways that mean something to those who hear it. Now when we have these connections to the Buddha and these contemplations, we can find great comfort in them in times of difficulty. So for example, one of the contemplations we do about death, and this is very helpful when you're sitting with someone who has this connection with the Buddha, someone who's dying, someone who's very ill, someone who maybe still is not completely at peace with the fact that their life is going to come to an end. One of the contemplations that we share at that time is that even the Buddha and all his great disciples passed away. None of them was able to outwit death. None of them was able to find a safe place beyond death. So if the Buddha, with all his powers, all his greatness, could die, what to say of us? Of course, as human beings, it's part of this inheritance that we're going to die. And so, just like the Buddha, we're approaching something that is not extraordinary. It's not particularly difficult if we understand that it's part of life. It's part of something that comes with birth. So, can we be at peace with that? And as we know, we very often struggle with the idea of why should this happen to me? Why me? Why did I get sick? Why did I get this accident? Why am I dying at this age? Many of the Buddha's disciples died at a young age, died through accident, died through illness. Why not me? If we have this connection to this great teacher and the teachers who came after him, we see this is just what goes along with birth, nothing extraordinary. And so even in difficult times, we can really find comfort. In more mundane situations, we can find comfort. Just recently at the monastery, we had some, we were having a breakfast which was trying to use up what had been offered to us, which had gone stale, which was full of weevils, and which we'd put out to let the weevils get out, make them go away, putting something in the sun until they'd all left, and then cooking up what was left as a porridge. And it was very untasty, I can tell you. We were all chewing away at this. And one of the stories that came to mind as I was chewing away was a story of the Buddha one time when he was observing the rains retreat. And if you are familiar with what happens at the rains retreat, you are determined to stay in one place for 3 months and not to leave that place during the 3 months. And usually you have some disciples who say that they were going to look after you for that 3 months and may even deliberately invite you to come and stay where they are so that they can look after you during the 3 months when you're doing more intensive practice. So at this, in this episode of the Buddha, known as the, someone known as the Brahman of Varanya, invited the Buddha and an assembly of monks to come and spend the 3 months rains retreat with them. And he would supply all the Sangha's needs during that 3 months. But what happened was that during that 3 month period, there was a famine, a drought, and the crops failed, and there was not enough food to go around. And so the Brahman, not being able to meet the needs of the Buddha and the Sangha, just sort of withdrew, disappeared, and didn't supply the Sangha with their needs, didn't even supply them with any of the supports. And so when the bhikkhus went on alms round, because there was a famine, there was very little food, and eventually people couldn't offer them alms food. But someone very kindly offered them the food that the horses were eating. Not the best grain, but just the chaff that was left over. And this was offered to the Sangha. And one day the Buddha could hear a pounding noise going on, and he asked Venerable Ananda, "What's that sound of pounding that's going on?" And Venerable Ananda said, "This is the monks pounding the chaff that we've been offered for our alms food. They have to soak it and they have to pound it to make it edible. And then after it's been soaked and pounded, then it can be eaten." And the Buddha said, "Very good, very good. This is what I like. This is a true renunciate. Accepting what's been offered, not complaining about it, and just simply eating it." And when I was eating the chaff the other morning at the monastery, as I was eating it, I not only recalled to mind that story of the Buddha, but I had a great sense of joy at thinking I'm following in the Buddha's footsteps. And as I made this reflection afterwards to the nuns, one of the nuns said, "That same story came up in my mind as I was eating, and I thought to myself, I bet even this is better than what the Buddha was eating. We're really much better off than the Buddha would have been in those times." And she also was eating her food with joy in the heart. So when we have this connection to not only the Buddha, but the lineage that we're in, and the fact that we're following in their footsteps, this can be a great source of joy and comfort, even in difficult times. In the times of disappointment, when we see that we don't get what we want, you might be disappointed in bigger ways than just not having a tasty breakfast to eat. But you can contemplate, I'm not alone in feeling this. The Buddha also faced disappointments. The Buddha also didn't always get what was comfortable, what was pleasing, what was pleasant. Many of the Buddha's disciples experienced great tragedy, great disappointment, great difficulty in their life, and yet they were able to overcome them. And so may I also be able to overcome this difficulty. And it can be a source of inspiration to think, now, how can I apply the teaching in this situation? How can I use this path of practice to help me see that this disappointment is actually pointing to the fact that I don't control life? Maybe what the Buddha was saying about we live in delusion was actually true. Can I see delusion in my own mind at this moment? And this helps us to actually use the difficulties in our life as a way of practicing, rather than thinking, once these difficulties are out of the way, then I'll be able to practice. Having this connection with the Buddha means that we recognize that the whole of our life can be used for our practice. And not only in our ordinary life, but when we sit down to meditate, we can deliberately bring up the contemplation on the qualities of the Buddha, and to contemplate what it must be like not to be irritated when things go the way we don't like, not to be upset when we can't get what we want, just to be content with any old thing. This is what it was like for the Buddha. And sometimes we can see, well, what's different between myself and the Buddha? Well, it's the work that needs to be done. The Buddha said we all have this
potential. That's what's so wonderful. It's not that we're stuck where we are forever. We just have to patiently keep putting in the effort, keep using the teachings we've received. And we too can come to that place of complete peace, complete freedom. Freedom internally, which makes us free externally. And so using this inspiration to contemplate the Buddha, the qualities of the Buddha, the purity of the Buddha, the Buddha's greatness in being able to show us the path of practice. Once we make that connection through the mind, and we contemplate that and make the connection through the heart, then we have a wonderful refuge, a refuge which never leaves us. That doesn't leave us when we're in good times and we can lose the balance of the mind in good times. Doesn't leave us in difficult times when we also can lose the balance of our mind. And then at the end of our life, however much we've been able to realize the truth of the teaching in our life, we can find refuge in the fact that we have done the Buddha's bidding, we have made good use of this human life, and that by practicing in this life, we have the opportunity to continue practicing wherever we're reborn. If we can hold our mind steady at the time of death, hold our mind steady on the Buddha, on the quality of purity of the Buddha, on the fact that we've made the best effort possible to walk in the Buddha's footsteps, that's our refuge at that time. I've seen for myself how people, even in their last moments of life, if they have that connection and they have someone there chanting even Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa, I've seen for myself people compose their mind, lose all fear at that moment, and even when they're very sick, raise their hands in Anjali. Rest in that refuge of the Buddha and find complete peace at that time in the moment of dying. This is something which is available to all of us, but we have to work, put in effort, and find that refuge for ourselves in our own heart. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you as we approach the month of Vesak. I encourage you to look again at the life of the Buddha, to look again at this wonderful path of practice that he's given to us, and to make good use of this precious human life to realize for yourself the refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. May this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana.
Sutta Dhammo Bhagavato Sangho.